Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutin.
Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Joining us on the show today, we have two-term DAP Member of Parliament, Ong Kian Ming. He recently announced his decision not to defend his Bangi seat in the 15th general elections and to take a break from active politics. Kian Ming, welcome to the show. It's good of you to join us. Let's talk about this bombshell that you dropped. Was that a decision long time coming? Was that always the plan to only serve two terms? Or was this a decision that you made due to recent circumstances?
Hi, Melissa, as well as Sharad. I'm joining you with my Rubik's Cube in my home office. Thanks for inviting me to share some views and thoughts on my recent announcement. Actually, the decision was already talked about among certain party leaders since last year. Last October, to be specific, I had already indicated to YB Tony Pua, my colleague who brought me into the party, that I was seriously considering not contesting in the next general election. And I also told him the reasons why. Subsequently, there were certain things that happened along the way that confirmed my decision not to run in the next general election, which I'm sure we can talk about in further detail.
Kian Ming, you have given many interviews already, kind of, elaborating the reasons and the dynamics behind the decision, including the fact that you might not have been in step with party members. And I wonder if you could just help us understand that at a deeper level. Was it simply your decision to promote the idea of an MOU at the kind of like the final stages of the Muhyiddin administration? Or does the issue go deeper? Is it a difference in political outlook between you and some of your colleagues that sort of put you in a very difficult position after you made those positions very clear?
Yeah, so just to clarify a bit, I don't think I was out of lockstep with the party members. I think there were some perhaps disagreements in terms of the direction of the party as well as the coalition in terms of strategy moving forward. And the CSA that was proposed by Muhyiddin, which was in some ways negotiated and discussed by Muhyiddin's representatives with myself and Tony Pua, was emblematic of that larger disagreement in terms of the direction of the party and the coalition. And I'll tell you why. I think one of the reasons why we felt it was necessary to think out of the box, to consider accepting or at least not rejecting outright Muhyiddin's CSA offer, is that we knew Dato' Sri Anwar Ibrahim did not have the numbers to form the government, even if, let's say, Tan Sri Muhyiddin were to step down. To just reject that proposal in favour of short-term populist kind of knee-jerk reaction by certain party leaders, not just in my party, but also other component parties, and not to see the larger picture, which I think most analysts would look at the current situation and probably think that there may have been good reasons, good strategic reasons to accept Muhyiddin's CSA offer. I think that is one of the challenges that DAP as well as Pakatan Harapan needs to face moving into the next general election and even beyond.
Well, but it wasn't just party leadership that had trouble accepting the CSA or the MOU. Even public buy-in was weak for this MOU. We saw that in the by-elections, the subsequent by-elections, that was in fact an issue for many who saw that perhaps as Pakatan Harapan maybe selling out to work with Ismail Sabri's government. Can I ask you, looking back, taking a step back and perhaps looking at a more broader view, when you think about MOUs, you think about CSAs, what has the process of negotiating, the trying to get the public buy-in, all of that, the political and electoral cost that comes with an agreement like this, what has that taught you about compromise and bipartisanship in Malaysia?
Okay, first of all, I think that political leaders should lead public opinion, especially in times of unprecedented crisis, both economic, political, and health related in the country, as what we were facing during the last 2 years of COVID. Hence, even if, let's say, public opinion was strongly against the CSA, perhaps less strong against the MOU later on, when people realized that we needed some stability in the country, political leaders should look at the broader strategic considerations and make decisions based on the longer-term interests of the country, including, for example, the possibility of equal allocation at the constituency level among all MPs, this anti-hopping law or constitutional amendment that we are, you know, at the final stages of discussion, and other political reforms that even if, let's say, the larger public doesn't feel immediately, would be good institutional reforms that Pakatan Harapan and DAP has been pushing for a long time, right? To reject all these institutional reforms just because certain public backlash, because everyone wanted to put Muhyiddin down for what he did to us in Sheraton Move, I think is to miss the forest for the trees. And if, let's say, you want to take a step even further back and look at the bigger picture, I think one of the reasons why the larger public is disenchanted with Pakatan Harapan is because after the Sheraton Move, we did not provide clear leadership and also a direction for the country to lead us out of COVID. I think those who attribute our performance in the state elections to us signing the CSA, the MOU, I think is very short-sighted because it really misses the fact that I think we could have been on the road, even if, let's say, we didn't win those two state elections, we could have been on the road to creating a better and more convincing narrative for the public if we had gotten our act together and provide clear leadership on how to lead the country out of COVID. And I think what we did instead was mostly point fingers at the federal government and without actually offering a clear alternative in terms of what we would have done if we were in government and what we would do if we were to become government again.
Kim Ming, I wonder if this, in some ways, the Pakatan Harapan had painted itself into a corner with the rhetoric of, treachery, pengkhianat, all these things, the kind of driving ground sentiment against those individuals and parties that had broken away from the Pakatan Harapan coalition. And then by doing that and playing only on sentiment and refusing to kind of deal with the more pragmatic issues, as you pointed out, that it wasn't able to turn back. I mean, what has gone on with the thinking? Or is there real thinking in terms of communication in Pakatan Harapan? What's been the conversation that you've been in to try and shift it to, as it were, the broader picture, the more pragmatic approach to politics?
I think that the narrative on pengkhianat, traitors and all that, probably couldn't have been avoided because the feelings were very raw and I think emotions were running high. Even with myself, I worked together with people like Saifuddin Abdullah, with many of the, so-called reformers that later on switched positions and, joined the other side. And definitely, I would be disappointed with many of their actions in terms of betraying the coalition. But of course, we need to also realize that the writing was on the wall in terms of some of the larger public reactions, if you will, in regards to the whole Kerajaan Gagal movement, for example. This is on hindsight, of course, but the fact that, we had a Kerajaan Gagal narrative that was being played out on social media in a very strong way, and yet the same Kerajaan Gagal, which comprised of many of the characters that we see in Muhyiddin's government as well as Sabri's government, won big in the Melaka as well as Johor state elections, showed to me that we were not able to convince the public that we were a better alternative, right? And I think going on emotions, in terms of criticizing the government alone, will not be able to win us more votes, especially among the larger Malay voter base, because they actually want to see leadership on how we can actually govern differently, apart from the normal calls for greater transparency and anti-corruption, which are important, but it's not necessary but not sufficient.
But you've said in other interviews, you said Harapan needs to keep its options open, and I'm just wondering whether you think that that advice might be heeded by party leadership, not just party leadership, but also how that might resonate with the sentiment on the ground?
I think that, again, I just want to repeat that we are living in unprecedented political times in the country, in the sense that we would never have been able to imagine a situation whereby UMNO would not be a dominant party and that BN would not be a dominant coalition. Right. So moving forward, my colleague Liu Chin Tong has also expressed this publicly. You know, we are in a situation where there are sort of like three kingdoms. The coalition led by Bersatu, Pakatan Harapan, as well as Barisan Nasional. So we do not know the kind of political configurations that would be necessary to govern at the national level as well as at the state levels moving forward. And if, let's say, we were to look ahead, 10, 20 years down the road, where we are at a much more politically matured kind of a stage of our political development, we may imagine a situation whereby we are at opposition at the federal level against one coalition, but we are together at the state, at the state level, together with that same coalition governing that state. This is a par for the course for countries like Germany, for example, where it has happened many times. Other federal countries have also experienced similar kind of models. Right, so when I say we need to keep our options flexible, this is thinking both short, medium, as well as long term. But it's not so easy for the public to understand. It's also not easy for many of the political leaders to explain this kind of flexibility.
Okay, Kianmi, we're going to take a quick break on the show. Let's come back and continue this conversation. We will be right back on Consider This. Don't go anywhere. Stay tuned. Thanks so much for staying with Sharad and I on Consider This. Let's continue our conversation with Bangi MP Ong Kian Ming. He recently announced that he will not be putting himself up as a candidate in GE15 and will be taking a step away from active politics. Sharad, you had a question.
Kian Ming, you started your career off in the academic world, correct me if I'm wrong, and you did a lot of analysis of voting trends and so on and so forth. You didn't decide to get into active politics. Was there a reason that you felt that active politics, becoming an MP, joining a political party, all these would in fact lead to some sort of change? I'm assuming that behind all your actions, including the recent one, there is a kind of theory of change. It's sort of a buzzword now, right? A theory of change. What is your theory of change, Kian Ming?
First of all, I have no regrets joining the political arena as a frontliner. It's been a fantastic ride over the past 9 years, and I'll continue to serve out my term, obviously, as Member of Parliament for Bangi. I've met so many wonderful and incredible people as a Member of Parliament, both in my constituency as well as in my travels around the country, as a Member of Parliament, as a politician, as well as a Deputy Minister. So I would encourage young people who aspire to want to join politics to really keep the faith, and know that good things can come through political activism and also political activity. And I have seen that with my own eyes, because like you say, the theory of change is part and parcel of what has happened in Malaysia over the past, I would say, three general elections, starting with 2000 and the 2008 general elections. And I have seen my own positive contribution in a small way. So, for example, I was the DAP representative for the Manifesto Committee for Pakatan Harapan before the 14th general election. And it was quite good to see some of these proposals being implemented, such as the 50 ringgit, the 100 ringgit unlimited travel pass that was implemented when Anthony Loke was the transportation minister. This was something that I put inside the manifesto. And there were a number of other initiatives related to renewable energy that Yobin also very ably tried to execute in her short time as a minister as well. So definitely the kind of impact that good politicians have, and I hope that I can call myself one, would be able to impact positively
Just on that note, if I may interrupt you, I think there are many who hold the view that you have performed well in your time as deputy minister, and many would hold you in this, you know, as a good politician. Some commentators even said that, you know, you wanting to step away from active politics is seen to be an example of political brain drain, and that might discourage people who are already disenfranchised with Malaysian politics. How would you respond to that?
I would somewhat disagree with that particular viewpoint, because like what I said in my public statement, I'm stepping away temporarily. I'm not retiring from politics. You know, I'm middle aged. I'm not that old yet. I still think that I have something positive to contribute to public policy making in the country. But I am confident that my party has a good group of capable and able leaders led by the Secretary General Anthony Loke, who would promote and give opportunities to other younger and more capable leaders to step up to the plate. So, you know, I've said this publicly, that I have already proposed a name, a person who is younger than myself, to replace me as the candidate for Bangi to the leadership. And if, let's say, the leadership is willing to make this public sooner rather than later, then definitely I'll be working with this individual. And people will be able to see that, look, this is part and parcel of a normal transition process, which perhaps can happen in other places as well, other constituencies, among other leaders who may want to take a step back and then give a chance and announce early and give a chance for his or her successor to sort of like have time to, you know, build his own base, build his own ground in the constituency and get ready for the next general election.
I mean, Kenny, you must be one of the rare politicians willing to step back, perhaps because you actually have skills that you can market in other fields. But I do want to come back to the question of where effective change can happen in this country. Considering that we are nominally democratic, we have had six decades of authoritarian rule, we have a crisis in our institutions, they've been hollowed out since Mahathir's first time as prime minister, everything from the judiciary to our civil service. This is a country in crisis. Is party politics the only real effective vehicle for change? Is there a space for civil society? Is there a space for think tanks, which I imagine you might retreat to? Where can you make a real difference in this country, considering our context?
Yeah, thanks, Sharad, for thinking that I have other marketable skills after my political career, or at least this phase of my political career is over. I think you're absolutely right in saying that there are other avenues for people to contribute, whether it is in civil society, such as Bursae, that I think continues to make a big impact in terms of areas of electoral reform, Transparency International and C4 and other civil society actors who are very active transparency-related matters, anti-corruption matters, and then also ideas and many other think tanks that have sprouted out over the past 10 years, you know, and many young, capable people are working in these places. I think that the civil service plays a very important role in terms of checking, you know, and balancing and working together with the government of the day so that, you know, the objectives of the larger public policy machinery in this country can be implemented. And there are also many other agencies and actors, you know, institutions like Bank Negara, for example, the Securities Commission. They also have important roles to play, you know, in the country. So I think there are many, many places where people can contribute. But of course, in politics, because of the stakes at play, because of the power that I've seen politicians, ministers, you know, prime ministers can wield, this is where I think still a lot of the important action will take place.
Okay. Ken Ming, you said that you're announcing this decision early to make way for a successor to get ready, so to speak. I'm wondering what lessons you've learned as a two-term MP, first in Serdang and now in Bangi. In Bangi, being this constituency of, you know, hundreds of thousands of voters, one of the biggest constituencies in the country, what lessons are you hoping to pass on? More importantly, what landmines are you hoping they can learn to sidestep?
Yeah, just for the record, Bangi is the largest parliamentary constituency in Malaysia. With 300,000 voters, probably more, you know, by the time the general elections come because of automatic voter registration. It's a Malay majority constituency, about 52-53% Malay, 38% Chinese, 10% Indians, and you know, that's sort of like a very heterogeneous constituency that is somewhat reflective of the larger population in Malaysia. So in terms of some of the lessons that I'll pass down to my successor, firstly, have a very good and strong team at the ground level so that you can work with them to handle matters on the ground, especially to do with different constituency issues. Secondly, don't be afraid to get your hands and feet dirty. You know, I've gone into the rivers in my constituency. I've picked up rubbish. I've done a lot of on the ground stuff, including upgrading a new running track in my constituency in Bangi. So don't be afraid of getting your hands dirty. And then thirdly, try to use some of your time to mentor the younger generation. I've had the pleasure of having almost 200 interns over my past 10 years as a member of parliament, as well as a party member and leader. And this is something that I'm quite proud of. And I hope that my successor can continue that tradition of inculcating young minds and influencing them to play a positive contribution to society.
Kim Ming, okay, so what can we expect to hear from you? Are you going to be working from inside the party? Is there a role for a non-MP to have influence in terms of the party's outlook, its policy agenda? Or are you going to be somewhere outside looking into the system and continuing to kind of play the role of a critic from the sidelines, as it were?
I've told the Secretary General of DAP, Anthony Loke, that I stand ready to provide inputs where necessary, whether it's in the issue of area of election analysis or in terms of public policy, finance and the economy, trade, which you know, I'm the spokesperson for now for the DAP. So that kind of role will continue, but from sort of like a support kind of role. With regards to commentating on Malaysia, I don't really want to be in sort of like the armchair critic kind of role. I hope to be in a position where I can actually put my academic as well as political experience to good use, to write more public policy papers and analysis that will be helpful to other public policy makers, not just in Malaysia, but perhaps on a regional basis. And I think this is something that I look forward to, getting to know more about the ASEAN landscape, rather than just to focus on Malaysia, which I've been very focused on for obvious reasons for the past 9 years as an MP.
All right, Kevin, we hope to catch you on your next adventure, your next chapter. Thank you so much for spending time with us today to talk a little bit about your experience as an MP.
Thanks for having me, as usual. Yeah.
That was our conversation with Bangi MP Ong Kian Ming, and that wraps up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutin, signing off for the evening.
Thank you so much for watching.
Good night.